Well, Shabbat Shalom. There's an old saying that says, seeing is believing. Matter of fact, we live right here by Missouri that has their motto as the show me state, implying, of course, that unless you show me, unless I can see it, I'm not going to believe that what you're telling me is true. And believe me, it's easy, very easy, to grow skeptical in this world, cynical about things, because we are constantly bombarded with, you know, television, movies, the whole entertainment industry. Politically, we're bombarded with what we're continually called fake news, right? And everything we see, it seems like, is either staged or blown out of proportion. So it tends to promote this feeling that we should just be so skeptical about everything. And when we hear something these days, it's like we're not at all sure we should believe it or not. And many times it's justified. However, I know that you know, but I don't know how deeply you know or understand that just because someone sees something in the biblical context, it does not mean that they will understand, or that you or I will understand or believe what we see, what we are told. And so the premise this morning is seeing is not believing. I want to begin today in John chapter 1 and verse 14. It says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." And I want that to set the stage today for this message. Realizing this, that Yeshua was seen. He was seen in the flesh. And He was no ordinary human being. It was God that people beheld. God. And so now I want to jump back here to verse 10. And talking about the Word, it said this: He was in the world, and the world was made by Him, and the world knew Him not. The people in His day and age saw Him. They saw Him, but did they believe? Did they see God in the flesh walking with them, teaching them, giving them the eternal truths of life, showing them how to live, both by word and also, of course, by example? Were they just so overwhelmed with awe that they had, you know, the presence of the all-knowing God? I mean, He proclaimed Himself as such, didn't He? Were they so overwhelmed that they said, "Oh yes, God, I believe. I'm going to follow You." Well, the biblical record tells us no. That wasn't their reaction. They did not know Him, even though they saw Him. John 11, next verse. "He came unto His own, and His own received Him not. But as many as received Him, to them He gave power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on His name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." See, just because one sees does not mean that he's going to believe. And that's because there is a spiritual aspect to this seeing and believing. The scripture here indicates that there wasn't even a flash of recognition as to His true identity. Today we have all sorts of people that go out of their way to be recognized. You know, you think of Elton John, you know, and his great big glasses, or rap stars and their big chains, and what was the guy with the big mohawk, the Pity the Fool, you know, what was his name? And Mr. T. These outlandish ways of being recognized or identified. But Consider Yeshua in contrast. Arguably the most unique, most influential personality to have ever stepped foot on this planet. An absolute one of a kind. The only one that was ever God, the only one that was ever stepped foot on this earth and lived a sinless life. And yet he could not be identified even by those that actually saw him. All of this seems to indicate that one has to be predisposed, I didn't say predestined, predisposed to receive this belief, this ability to actually see. It's interesting in the context here of verses 12 and 13, especially, that those who exercise this faith, it says, to them he gave the power, which is the right or the authority, the ability, if you will, to become the children of God. That is, to enter into a relationship with God that results in nothing less than the creation of a new being. I want to continue this thought now in John chapter 7. And we're going to see here an incident that occurred in the life of Christ that shows the truth of what I'm trying to say here. That seeing is not necessarily believing. Okay? John 7 verse 1. After these things, Yeshua walked in Galilee. For he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now think about that. Not only did they not recognize him as who he was, but they wanted to kill him. The very Creator God walking among them. In John 7, if we were to drop down to verse 5, we'd see that even his brothers, even his family, didn't believe in him. Those of his own family who lived with him day in and day out, they didn't believe in him. Here we have people actually living with God in the flesh, and they couldn't see him. Didn't see him as who he was. And so then he goes to the feast, and we read this, John 11 now, or verse 11, still John 7. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much complaining among the people. There's a lot of talk, a lot of stirring up about this. And some said he's good, and others says, "No, on the contrary, he deceives the people. He deceives the people." And you imagine God in the flesh deceiving people? No. How wrong can you get? How much can you not see that this is the one that embodies all truth? And you're saying he deceives people. A few scriptures down in verse 20, someone actually accuses him, believe it or not, of having a demon. And there's all of these opinions circled about. Dropping down to verse 40. Therefore many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, "Truly this is the prophet." Others said, "This is the Christ." Well, there's a glimmer of hope there. But some said, "Will the Christ come out of Galilee?" Out of Galilee? No. Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem, where David was? See, we look at all these opinions that people held about him. It's all over the map and mostly wrong. In Matthew 16, we're aware of this when Yeshua asked Peter, "Who do men say that I am?" What was his answer? He said, "Well, some say that you're John the Baptist. Others say that you're Jeremiah or one of the other prophets." See, now Peter finally got the answer right, but he's saying some people say John the Baptist, some say one of the other prophets or Jeremiah. There was so much confusion regarding his identity, they didn't see him. When he tried to go teach in Galilee, where he grew up, what happened there? He was not hardly accepted at all. Which led him to say, and I didn't write the reference down, but you've heard it before, where he said that, you know, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and his own household. See, if he can't be, listen to this, If he can't be clearly identified, how can he be worshipped? So we're beginning to see then an application here for you and I. Will he be working in our lives if we don't see him? Will he, can he be working in our lives if we don't see him? If we don't recognize him interfacing with us in all parts of our life, if we're not sensitive to his promptings, if we don't understand his purpose and what he's working out in our individual lives, in you and in me, if we can't see that, if we can't see him, how can we worship him? How can we walk with him? I don't think we can. See, we have come out of a world in which there is just as much, guys, if not more, confusion regarding him, regarding his identity as to when he was walking on the earth. And my concern is not whether we can identify him, because we have identified him as the Christ, haven't we? We have fully identified him. We know who he is. But do we really see him in our lives, vital part of our lives? Can we, to put it another way, can we punch through the physical plane of our sight and see him spiritually? See, all these people could see was a human being. They saw with their physical eyes. And by limiting that, they missed seeing a spiritual God in front of them, because they were not using spiritual eyes. That's sink in a minute. I'm going to go to Hebrews here in a moment. You know, when you read Hebrews, you can really come to grips with your physicality, with how limiting that is, and how physically, so physically oriented that we are and that we can be. In this physicalness, for lack of a better word, this orientation that we have, this concern with the material that all of us have to a lesser or greater extent, that plays a powerful role in whether or not we are ever really going to see God in our lives. Okay, so let's go there. Hebrews 1, verse 10. And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish. You know, we've proven that. The universe, now it's going to take, what, a few trillion, whatever, but it's expanding to the point where it's going to get to the point where it will fall apart. It says they will perish, but you remain. And they will all grow old like a garment, like the cloak. You will fold them up and they'll be changed. But you are the same, and your years will fail not. Now to you and me, the physical seems so solid, doesn't it? It's virtually indestructible, and it's permanent in that sense, especially to us in this short time that we're here. It's permanent to us. But the book of Hebrews is telling us to get our attention off of that which is immediate. I'm going to call that the around and about, the physical, the around and about, that which is so physically oriented to us. We are to get our lives, our thinking, and our focus out of that area and into the eternity of Christ's dominion. That's where he dwells. That's where he's inviting us to. And one of the profound realities of God in his word is that they are changeless. It says here, you remain. We grow old and die, but the eternal values never change. And even more exciting than that, they can be taken through the grave. because they will outlive us. So, what in life is important? Is it the immediate gratification now that's offered in this world? Is it the around and about? And if that's your focus and all of your focus, I'm saying that it's not likely that you will see God. I want to illustrate it to you this way. I'm going to give you a little test. Take a moment and look at this. What do you see? I don't know. I kind of see two horses, maybe a little bit. Maybe some fat lobsters down there at the bottom or something. Doesn't really matter. That's not the point. If I take this away, and then I ask you, what did you see? It was an ink blot, okay? What did you see? Well, most of us, probably everybody here, concentrated on the ink, on the image. You all saw the spot, but did anybody consciously see the paper? It's there. The paper. Did anybody consciously see the paper? See, we don't think about it. We think about the ink, or we think, well, what does that ink represent to us? What did I see in the ink? But we didn't see the paper. And see, I'm trying to make this point. We see what we want to see. We see what we're educated to see. And we see what we look for. Are you using physical eyes? Are you using spiritual eyes? See, it's, we see what we expect to see. Now that's pretty much the way it is with regard to the physical and the spiritual, isn't it? If all you are looking for is the physical impact and result and implications of things, of your decisions, of things that happen to you, of your circumstances, then I promise you that is all you're going to see. It's all you're going to see. However, the converted mind is predisposed to be able to perceive the spiritual aspect of a circumstance. If we're predisposed to this way by the calling and the gift of God and His Spirit. But we still must make the choice to see it, to look for it. So with the Spirit of God in you, you have the ability to do that, but you still need to utilize it. You must make the choice to look for the spiritual. We must make the choice to follow through on the spiritual, regardless of the cost on the physical side. Did you catch that? We must make the choice to look for the spiritual. We must make the choices to follow the spiritual, even at the expense of the physical. Consider Hebrews 4. In speaking about the ancient Israelites, it says this, "Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them." Again, speaking of the ancient Israelites. "But the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it." See, they saw a multiple of things, didn't they? They saw a lot. Miracles done by God through His servant Moses, and on occasion through Aaron. They experienced water in Egypt, right? Turning to blood. They experienced hopping frogs all over the place, right? They experienced the division. Think about that, between Goshen and Egypt. They were spared from the plagues that came upon Egypt. They knew that there was something working in their lives, did they not? Did they not see it occurring when the bugs were all over Egypt but not in the land of Goshen? Or when hail fell on Egypt but not on Goshen? And especially when the firstborn of Egypt were all killed, but the obedient Israelites that did what they were supposed to on Passover, they were spared. Did they not spend 40 years in the wilderness where day after day God faithfully fed them manna and quail? Did they not see with their eyes water gushing out of a dry rock? He fed them. He watered them. He saw it all with their eyes, a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. They saw the glory of God descending upon Mount Sinai. They felt the earth shake under their feet. They saw the glory of God come down on the tabernacle after it was built. Yet despite all of that, every single one of them, except for two, died in that wilderness. They perished for lack of sight. So I ask, is merely seeing believing? No. And I'm saying to all of us, when I point, there's how many coming back to me. Saying to all of us, we're here. We're keeping the Sabbath, right? We've engaged with God. We've all acknowledged Him. But the question today is, do you really see Him? Do you see what is happening spiritually around you and inside your life? Guys, can you examine the past and project that out to the future spiritually? Is seeing believing? These people never saw God in those works. What they physically saw did not produce spiritual faith, which enables one to see God. Because as these two verses show, there has to be a voluntary response by the ones given the ability to see. See, the Christian has the responsibility of responding to God by acts of faith. The apostle here is reminding these people of the deadly seriousness of their situation. God's calling is not indiscriminately mimeographed out for all who might by chance see or read it. Your calling is a personal invitation. It's been addressed to you. The warning is that since ancient Israel did not enter into God's rest, somebody will, because God will carry through with His purpose and His plan and His will. And we need to very seriously consider Israel in that wilderness. They heard the message. They saw. But did they see? No, because they didn't respond. If you read the preceding chapters in the book of Hebrews, you'll find that their failure to respond is variously called hardness of heart, unbelief, disobedience. And even though all of those words are distinctly different, in this context, they're all really synonyms of one another. So now, listen, why did this occur? Because Israel wanted to go back to Egypt. Their eyes were backwards. Their eyes were on the physical. They were not seeing what God was doing. They saw Him, but they didn't see Him. They were looking at all of the events through Egyptian-trained eyes. Because again, we see what we want to see. We see what we're educated to see. And we see what we are looking for. Family, we have to live on the basis of the words of promise. Hebrews 11:13 says of the old prophets that they all died in the faith. Remember the faith chapter, and they listed all these. And they all died in the faith. The heroes of the faith all died having not received the promises, but having seen them, they saw them afar off. And they saw them and they rejoiced in them. And because of that, it changed them. They believed what they saw. They identified with it and they identified God in it. And it transformed who they are, how they made decisions, how they analyzed everything. It gave them great direction in their lives and set them apart from all the rest of mankind. How important is it that we take advantage of this opportunity to consciously include God in all of our thinking? Well, I want to look at John 6:29, and Yeshua will answer that question. He says, "This is the work of God, that you believe." That you believe in Him whom He sent. He is saying there that the purpose of giving some the ability to see God is to produce faith, to produce a walk with Him. Further down in verse 40, we have a clear statement of Yeshua regarding those who He has called and given to Christ. Here it is. "And this is the will of Him who sent me, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in Him may have everlasting life, and I'll raise him up at the last day." Now, does He mean physically? Is that what He's talking about? I think you know the answer to that is no. He means sees here in the sense of comprehends or perceives or understands. And so this is the will of Him who sent me, that everyone who sees, who comprehends, who perceives or understands the Son and believes in Him will have everlasting life, and I'll raise him up. See, we have to see God. We have to comprehend Him in every part of our life. We read in Psalms that the fool says in his heart there is no God. And we've said that of atheists. Because, you know, none of us would say that, right? We all agree that there's a creator God. We would never say that there is no God. So we're all in good shape there, right? We're not a fool. Or are we? And not even realize it. Let me explain. Fool, in there, where it says that a fool says in his heart there's no God, the word is Nabal. N-A-B-A-L. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Nabal or Nabal. Do you guys remember David and Abigail? Remember that David was going to go after her husband because he... I can't tell the whole story because we don't have time. But she is the one that intervened and came out and before David and his army could get to him. And she basically saved her husband's life. Abigail's husband was named Nabal. And he was a fool. That word means someone who is contemptible. Someone who is empty. It doesn't mean necessarily an atheist. It doesn't mean someone that has no contact with God at all. It doesn't mean that that person doesn't see God in the creation. The fool that is being described there may readily, quickly admit that there is a God of creation, and maybe even ascribe that worship of Him as part of their life. He may clearly admit and profess God, the creator. This person, this fool, this Nabal, is not an atheist. See, he would acknowledge God. But he lives as if he is persuaded that there is not a God that's intervening in his life, with no ability to either bless or curse him depending upon how he walks. See, a Nabal is not stupid. He's not a person who doesn't not reason or think, but he's a person who reasons or thinks wrongly. A Nabal is a person who chooses, and an assumption is a choice, to ignore the fact that God has authority over his life. So it's one thing to acknowledge that God exists. It's another thing to say God has authority over my life. He's working in my life. He's involved in all these little things that I'm doing. He's ignoring God in that way. And so basically he just sees God as like an absentee landlord or something who may be safely discarded, because the fool assumes that God is really not active in his creation. See, the fool's problem is not with his brain, but his heart. The fool is capable of grasping the things of God, but there is no real fear attached to that or reverence for God and the things of God. What this results in is nothing less than practical atheism. Because even though he may readily admit that God is creator, he lives his life as though God doesn't exist or is not involved. So in that way, he's produced this kind of dichotomy in his life, you know, a dichotomy between what he believes intellectually and what he actually walks out in his life. And God says that person is a fool, because he says in his heart there is no God. Not only his mind. He says in his heart there's no God. And that's sobering, because any one of us can fall into that definition of that word. See, Psalm 14:5 says that the fool comes to great fear, that Nabal comes to great fear. Now, why? Why would it say that? Because, see, the fool is aware of God. When the punishment, the curse comes, when God begins to reveal himself, then there is great fear. Now, why would there be fear? If there is no God, he wouldn't fear it, but he does fear. Because he knows up here there's a God, but he lives his heart like there isn't. And guys, when we really see God, when we begin to view life through the lens of reality, of him working in us, then we grow. And it's an educational process designed to help us see what is important and what is of lesser value. What is reality, eternal reality, and what is just vanity. Not embracing God in all aspects of life makes one a biblical Nabal, a fool, saying in his heart that there is no God. Not that he doesn't exist, but that he's just not involved. So therefore, I can do whatever I want. We need to see God. Keep saying that. Because when we really see God, when we walk this life with him, then it begins to gel. You know, this walking with him, it brings me to an interesting story in Luke. And this occurred right after the resurrection. Chapter 24. Now behold, two of them were traveling that same day to a village called Emmaus, which was 7 miles from Jerusalem. Now this was right after the resurrection. And they talked together of all these things which had happened. I'm sure that the whole area was abuzz with this. And so it was, while they conversed and reasoned, that Yeshua himself drew near and went with them, walking alongside of them. Now, I don't want to go over here, but for time I'm not going to go into great detail. But the point I want you to understand is they were walking, right? So, you know, we're walking along. Life goes on. These guys were heading to another city, maybe to, you know, buy some new robes or something. I don't know. But, you know, they were doing life. And Yeshua comes up and is walking with them, right? You know, there's movement in life, and we move from the point of birth to, you know, growing up, and then we have our calling, and then we walk through that, and then, you know, we die. When we die, we stop walking. These guys were walking, they were living. And Yeshua is leading us and guiding us by his Spirit. He's walking there. He is convicting us of things that are going to be important in the spiritual realm. Walking and being with us. Do you see him? Are you walking with him? Do you recognize him there? See, in this case in Luke 24, he was literally physically right there, walking right beside them. They did not recognize him. They didn't see him. Now, some might think that God had blinded them to him. And I've thought that for a long time, but I'm questioning it now. I don't know about that. Because of something that the passage says, but I want to start here. 17. He said, "What kind of conversation is this that you've had with one another as you walk and are sad?" Christ says. One of them, whose name was Cleophas, answered and said to him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? You live under a rock? Have you not known the things which happened there these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" So they said to him, "The things concerning Yeshua of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people." Now think about this. We've got two men that knew of Yeshua. It wasn't that they didn't know about him walking along. They already knew about him. They had followed everything that had happened, and yet they still didn't see him. They had knowledge, but they didn't see him, didn't recognize him. Why? Because they didn't expect to see him. What do we see? What we're looking for. What we're educated to see. Unless we make the effort to be discerning, to consciously think about other aspects of what we're doing and what we're looking at and analyzing them, it's very likely that we're not going to see what God is doing. We have to consciously process the truths that we are receiving from God as we are involved in circumstances, as we walk with Christ. Or we might just well be walking along with Christ and he's there and we don't see him either. And this can happen if we don't identify the circumstances that we are going through with spiritual eyes. When the spiritual is not perceived, it is overlooked. When the spiritual is not perceived, it is overlooked. When it is not perceived, it's overlooked. And it takes us doing that, looking. Look at verse 25. This is why I think that they were not divinely blinded, because Yeshua said to them, "Oh, foolish ones." Now, if they were blinded, why were they foolish? See, this word in the Greek means inconsiderate, meaning they were not considering things. They weren't thinking. They weren't seeing. They weren't reasoning right. It's very similar to the word Nabal in the Old Testament. Oh, foolish ones. They were not properly applying their minds. They simply did not believe, even though they had been taught. See, they did not believe the things that appeared in the Old Testament describing the Messiah and the resurrection. They knew all about it. And so because of that, they didn't see Christ who was standing right there walking with them, because they didn't expect to see it. And so Christ called them fools. And he not only calls them fools, which shows me that he expected them to be able to identify him. They had enough information to be able to identify him, or else he wouldn't have called them fools. He also called them slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had spoken. So in other words, they knew all of that the prophets had spoken about him. But they were slow of heart. Nabal. They even said in verse 21, if you want to go back over this afterwards, they said in verse 21 that they were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. That's what they were hoping for. That's what they were looking for. But it was physical. They were looking for the physical. And see, I think their hope was really nothing more than just wishful thinking. But I think it is significant that it doesn't say in their response as they talked to him that they trusted him. You see, they weren't using any faith. They weren't using belief. Because there's a big difference, isn't there, not between hoping and trusting? See, trusting requires making choices and patient endurance. At the end of all of this, when they finally saw Yeshua, when they perceived who it was that was with them, then everything that they had heard and seen and all of that began to make sense then. Everything they had experienced, when they looked at it spiritually, came together and made sense. That's what can happen with us. And that's why we need to get the point of why this story is included in our Bible. Because if you can see God working in your life, then everything will begin to come together just like it did for them. It may not all at once, like when, you know, the flash of revelation happened to them as they were walking along. It may not happen like that, but it will come together when we put our experiences in the proper perspective. If you can see God involved in the circumstances of your life, as you walk this walk with Yeshua, it will come together. It's going to give shape and form to your life in a way that you never would have had otherwise. Things are going to make the proper kind of sense when you actually see God. When you put it in proper perspective. See, we can see God if that's what we're looking for. However, if, you know, it's very easy. I get it more than you know. That it's very easy for our carnal minds to rule us, to be blinded by our traditions and our habits and our ways of thinking. The effect of that is something like this. Remember that story about the elephant? And they blinded three men, and they brought them to the elephant, and they had one touch the tail, and he says, it's a rope, and one touched the trunk, oh, it's a snake. One touched the leg, oh, it's a tree, right? That was the perspective. This is what can happen to us. See, the world is able to perceive bits and pieces, but they can't put the whole thing together and see the glory of God as a whole, to see the proper to see that is in the proper place of the life of a man. Not only proper, but absolutely necessary to get the whole picture. Like the whole spiritual elephant, so to speak. If it is seen and if it is understood, then life begins to make sense. We begin to be able to see ourselves, this single, unique individual. Us, I, you, me. As a part of the whole. And this awesome plan that God has for us. And see that working out in every little part of your life. And being able to see God gives a direction. So then your eye has seen, your ear has heard, and has entered into your heart the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. And there is no greater attempt at speaking than two precious little grandchildren up there. And I don't know. It's only through God's Spirit that maybe you guys have heard a thing I said today.
Hashtag spiritual. But
that's right.
Have been trying.
Okay.
True test.
We're looking for it.
Because I just said, being able to see God. And this is, I don't want you to miss this. When we're seeing God, as we're walking, as we're doing, I mean, we're talking about living with another set of eyes. Right? And then that's what he's talking about when he says, that your eye has seen, and your ear has heard, and it has entered into your heart the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. 1 Corinthians 2. But God has revealed them to us through His Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Okay? So, likewise, right? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. And so we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might freely know the things that have been freely given to us by God. The ability to see him. But we have to look. These three verses prove that we are predisposed by God's calling to see him. So we can know, we can see, if we are looking. We may not know perfectly, and that's okay. But what we can know is a source of great comfort, security, and hope, and direction as we walk through life. Look at verse 13 and onward. These things we also speak, not in words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they're foolishness to him, nor can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. But he who is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is rightly judged by no one. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. Was asked earlier, what is true wisdom? True wisdom is the result of human reason coupled with revelation, and then the ability to apply that knowledge. But even true wisdom will result only if a person believes what God says. And that's when a person has the opportunity to see God. And it's hidden from those who put their faith in human reason. Natural, in this context, in verses 13 through 15, doesn't mean evil. It simply refers to a person whose horizons are bounded by the things of natural life, by the, you know, the around and about. Such a person is not equipped to discern the activities of God. That person, you know, can't do it. But a person with the Spirit of God can examine that area and scrutinize it. And therefore, in that process, God comes in the picture, and then we can see him. When God's Spirit comes into a person's life, the basis for how he or she makes judgments should change. It's not because the person is any greater or better, but because the Spirit of God has equipped that person to see and to use the wisdom of God, because now he can judge things from God's perspective. That is how we walk with God. We can't walk with God, we can't see him. You know, and it happens a little at it, you know. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you all know that story, right? I mean, the king built a thing and they were supposed to bow to it every day, and if you didn't, you're going to, you know, be suffer at the hand of the king. And you know, these three guys wouldn't do it, so they got reported, and he said, you know, throw them in the furnace. What did they do? They said, no, we're not going in the furnace, you know, we're not going to bow. If you're going to put us in the furnace, put us in the furnace. Now, how could they say that? You know, that's going to hurt. But they could say it for two reasons. One, they knew that if God wanted to spare them, that he could. That either he'd talk the king out of it or whatever, but they put their hands, themselves in the hands of God, not in the hands of this king. And secondarily, they said, well, if this king kills us, he can only kill the body, he can't kill me. I'll sit in the grave and I'll wait a resurrection. Now, how did they have that much power? How did they have that much confidence? I know exactly how. Because they had that same confidence every single day in a gazillion little things for years leading up to that. They were used to making decisions, making sacrifices, looking at the spiritual in light of the physical circumstances, and they were used to seeing the spiritual circumstances above the physical. And so when it came to that massive test, it wasn't, you know, I mean, I'm sure it created some anxiety, but there was no question. Because they had trained themselves day after day after day, walking this way, making these decisions that way already. You see? That kind of commitment doesn't just come on command at the spur of a moment. That comes as fruit of demonstration of God in the lives of these men over and over for years. And I'm saying to you, why don't we see things like this today? It's because we spend so little time fellowshipping with God that we don't see Him as an immediate and vitally important part of our lives. People are not walking with God, seeing Him in every part of their lives and building confidence that would stand in the face of something like this. So what happens is that we get overwhelmed by the physical, by the around and about. I'm running out of time, but just quickly think about Job. Same thing. God at the beginning said, "Hey, Satan, consider my servant Job." You know, He extolled some of his good qualities. You know, Job was a very spiritually mature man. And so God said, "Yeah, Satan, you can go do this, just don't kill him." And so physically He wiped Job out, man. I mean, all his wealth, all his family, his health, physically the man was devastated. And we read 30 some odd chapters of him whining and complaining about it to his so-called friends and his wife and to God before God finally said, "Hey, Job, whoa, big shot, where were you when I did this? Where were you when I set the foundations of the earth? Where were you when I lit the sun up?" And then Job finally got it, right? And so he becomes... His understanding even grew even more, and he got this gigantic perspective of what's vitally important and what's not. Right? And so, you know, we do life a certain way. And will we do life the way that He wants it done? Well, because what Job figured out is that if we don't do life the way that He wants it done, we're not going to do life at all. And my question is, do you really believe that? Do I really believe that? I mean, not here, but here. And I'm saying examine yourself because, you know, think about it. Even at the beginning of the book of Job, like I said, he was a very spiritually mature man. And he didn't get it. He finally did at the end of the book. But he didn't at the beginning, and he was very spiritually mature. Consider this as we begin to wrap up. Isaiah 46. "Remember this and show yourselves men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me. Declaring the ending from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, My counsel shall stand." My counsel shall stand. He's not of absentee God. He's walking right there. Do you see Him? Because He says, "I will do all my pleasure." What we have in these three verses is a general principle in which God challenges us to consider, to compare all the material idols which are so easily seen to Him. See, that's what Job did. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. That's what David did. That's what others did. They saw God. They saw Him above everything in their lives and in everything in their lives. Because this word "remember" is a very important word to a true spiritual religion. It's remembering every day and everything that God's counsel stands. When He says something, it is so. And as we see God in everything we do in this life, with our spiritual eyes open and discerning the physical by the spiritual, not the other way around, okay? then as we do, we personally build our own supply of former things. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego relied on. The former things of their lives, the things that they had built up to stand on when the going gets rougher. God gives plenty of evidence to demonstrate that he can be trusted. Being able to see God and have faith is a result of seeing the past evidence and then looking for him in the present and trusting him toward the future. And that's why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could face that fire. They remembered their former things and their walk with God. They knew God would be faithful because they trusted him and walked with him in thousands of little ways already. And I'll close with this. In Joshua, he said this at the end of his life. Chapter 23, verse 14. Behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth. And you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spoke concerning you. All have come to pass for you. Not one word of them has failed. God is ultimately faithful. He is here for you. So I ask again, do you see him? You'll see what you're looking for. You all believe, but do you see him in all aspects of life? Are you looking? Are you opening your eyes every day to evaluate the physical by the spiritual? As God said through Isaiah, we have to remember to do so. And as we do, our ability to see God is reinforced and built through obedience to his counsel. And as you walk that way, your own experience will show you that God's faithfulness stands firm. And then in the midst of any storm, no matter how dark, no matter how bleak it gets, you can truly see God. Amen.